Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This is WBUR.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Tonight, a feminist critique of the war on terror. So far, the conversation has been male-dominated, from the anchor desk to the White House to the caves of Afghanistan. Where are the women in this crisis, and could they do it this better? First, the rush to test a new version of the smallpox vaccine. U.S. officials consider smallpox, which is deadly, highly contagious, and once considered eradicated, to now be perhaps the number two biological threat behind anthrax. Health and Human Services Secretary Tommy Thompson wants the drug companies to manufacture enough smallpox vaccine for every American within a year. In the meantime, researchers are attempting to find out if they can stretch the current supply by diluting it. I spoke earlier with Dr. John Traynor, who's testing the diluted vaccine at the University of Rochester Medical Center. I asked him why volunteers have been fighting to get into the trials.
Well, I think people are volunteering to be in this study for many of the same reasons that they volunteer for any research study. It's a variety of things, including curiosity about the study, interest in the science, desire to help people by finding ways to prevent diseases. In this particular case, I think there's also people who are doing it out of a sense of patriotism and, in some cases, because of their own fears of coming in contact with smallpox.
Is that a reasonable fear for them or for anyone at this moment?
Well, that's actually a question that I can't answer. You'd have to know a lot more background assessing who really does have the virus and what's the likelihood that it'll be used, and I simply don't know.
But you're working on the science of it. Explain for us, how are you testing this version of the vaccine at Rochester and three other university research centers?
Well, this is really a very simple study. We're using the old Dryvax vaccine that was used 40 years ago.
This is the one that anybody over 35 or so has got a little dime-sized crater on their shoulder.
Right. It's exactly the same vaccine. And we know from past experience that when you get that vaccine, you develop a little dime-sized sore on your arm called a pustule. And if you get that pustule, you're protected against smallpox. So all we're really trying to do here is to see whether, if we give the vaccine in a diluted form, people will still get the pustules. And if it does do that, then we'll know that the diluted form would be effective in preventing smallpox.
What are the prospects for an effective diluted version of the vaccine? Presumably the old vaccine was developed at a strength designed to protect people against the virus. Why do you think a weaker version might work?
Well, the old vaccine was very, very easy to make and cheap to produce, so there was no reason to try and dilute it at all. It worked fine undiluted, and since it was working, why fool around with it?
Mm-hmm.
We do know from past experience, though, with that old vaccine and studies that were done many years ago, and also in an NIH study that was done at St. Louis University a few months ago, that the diluted vaccine probably will work. What we're trying to do now is to determine exactly, with a lot of precision, how many people will get takes or pustules with the diluted vaccine.
Mm-hmm. The smallpox vaccine has an interesting history, and it started out as a rather dangerous vaccine to be administered, I guess, but people were so worried about smallpox, they took it anyway.
Well, the history of vaccination against smallpox goes way, way back to the 18th century. Some of the types of vaccines that were used 200 years ago were somewhat dangerous. As a matter of fact, 200 years ago, people actually used to give themselves the smallpox virus to try and head off a case of smallpox. But the current vaccine, the one that we're using now, is relatively safe. It certainly was used in literally billions of people over the course of the eradication campaign that eliminated smallpox. And while it does have some side effects, it's a fairly safe vaccine and very, very effective.
If these trials are successful, how quickly could these diluted vaccines reach local doctors and their patients? Are there plans for mass vaccination, or is this just to be prepared in case of an outbreak?
Well, my own interpretation of what we're doing is that we're putting together a backup plan that could be used if there was a real emergency and a need to use the Dryvax vaccine again and give it to many, many people. I think looking at the big picture, we hope that, of course, the vaccine will never be used, or that if we were going to be talking about vaccinating, we'd be using newer generation vaccines, which are currently in the process of being produced.
We all hope it doesn't come up, but even if you find that you can successfully dilute the vaccine, there still wouldn't be enough to go around nationally, would there?
Well, right now, I think the estimate is that stored away are about 12 to 20 million doses of smallpox vaccine. And if the 1 to 10 dilution were to be effective in inducing takes, then we would really have access to about 200 million doses of smallpox, which would probably be enough to contain any kind of outbreak that we might experience here in the States.
That is smallpox vaccine, and that gives you some comfort.
Yes. I think, you know, a successful outcome in this study will give us a degree of comfort in terms of how we would deal with an exposure to smallpox if that were to occur.
Dr. Trainor, does it blow your mind that you're working on smallpox vaccine in the year 2001?
I'd have to say yes. I think that any person would view this really as an enormous step backwards. The fact that we as a race of people, the human race, are considering needing to go back to vaccinating against smallpox, which was one of the great scourges of mankind and which had actually been eradicated, is really unthinkable, and it's a very upsetting thought.
Dr. John Trainor is an associate professor of medicine and is the University of Rochester Medical Center's principal investigator for the new smallpox vaccine trials. I spoke to him earlier today. It's true, President Bush's national security director is an African-American woman. But with the exception of Condoleezza Rice, there are precious few prominent women prosecuting this war. Women's voices, their visions, their perspective have been low profile in the high profile debate over the war on terror. That may not surprise many observers of the gender divide. War has always been a largely male endeavor. But women are talking, and we need to hear their voices as America gropes its way through the war on terror. If women ran the world, would the United States be in this crisis? How would America be responding? Is there a better way? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us in the studio is Jyoti Puri. She's professor of sociology and women's studies at Simmons College in Lexington, Massachusetts, and the author of the forthcoming book, Introducing Nationalism. Welcome, Jyoti Puri.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. And with us here in our studios in Boston tonight is our news analyst, Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, good to have you in the flesh.
Hi, Tom.
So, we're talking about the feminist view of the crisis, and is there an alternate view? And Professor Jyoti Puri, let me put it to you, is there another way of looking at this crisis, this conflict? Is there a feminist way, and is that view being heard?
Tom, you're asking me a complicated set of questions, and I think I would start by saying that there are numerous feminist views. I think it's hard to synthesize all of this, the differences, the ambivalences, into one single position.
We expected no less.
Thank you. You're well prepared. I think in terms of what feminists have to contribute to this discussion, and if there is a different way of looking at it, I think there are patterns. Again, I would reiterate that there are important differences between feminists, but I think there are also distinct patterns. Mm-hmm. And some of the pieces that feminists have really talked about well before September 11th, which are important and very relevant to the events that happened on September 11th and since then, has to do with the rise of nationalism, but also its pitfalls, especially in the U.S., since we're talking about the context of the United States right now. Mm-hmm. I think the role of fundamentalism that has really shaped the attacks as well as the counter-response since September 11th, as well as terrorism. For example, you asked, you know, is there an alternative way of looking at this? And I think one of the responses that feminists would give you, at least some critical feminists, would be that terrorism, it's important to look at terrorism, understand it, but let's understand it as a symptom rather than the cause. And I think my fear is, and some of the people who share this position, is that right now the U.S. government and some of its allies are really responding to it as if it is the cause.
Jyoti Puri, when you point to terrorism, fundamentalism, and nationalism as issues from a feminist perspective, do you mean to say that there's a gender root to each of these things somehow?
I think gender is an important aspect of all of this. But when I said that these are three of the important things that feminists are contributing, I guess what I'm also saying is that I'm saying two things. One is that these issues are very closely tied to gender differences, and I think you alluded a little bit to that in your opening statement. Mm-hmm. But also that given feminist work on this, it's interesting that some of these issues haven't been touched on adequately in the larger discourse that has taken place since September 11th. So it's, I think, both of those pieces.
We want to dig into all of that tonight. Maybe the best thing to do is just start by going through in a thumbnail way, in a sketch way, with each of these, maybe starting with terrorism. Do you see a gender facet or angle to terrorism? How would you describe it?
One of the ways in which the gender facet, I think, of terrorism has been talked about, and again, there's a lot of feminist work that has been done on this, is really broadening the definition of terrorism itself, so that right now we're really thinking about the September 11th attacks as, you know, the primary markers of terrorism. That's really what people have in mind when we think about terrorism. But also the broader aspects of terrorism, which have to do with various kinds of violence, systemic kinds of violence that have been directed toward women. And a lot of feminists have asked that issues around sexual assault or even the policies of the Taliban, which are so much under scrutiny right now, be really included in that wider definition of terrorism.
But you're tying then the violence that we associate with terrorism to a broader range of violence and tying it to males.
That's correct. And again, this is not to sort of, I'm not proposing a simplistic viewpoint in that, you know, so terrorists, however defined, are always male, and then the victims are typically women. I don't think that's true at all. Mm-hmm. In fact, we know that women have been, even in terms of the using the mainstream definition of terrorism, we know that women have been involved in these organizations. Mm-hmm. So again, it is to be able to look at terrorism in a broader context and to also look at the role of women and its impact on women in a broader way.
How about fundamentalism? Do you see that as somehow male-driven as well?
Oftentimes it is, and even if it isn't male-driven, it tends to take a very masculinist rhetoric. So even when women are part of fundamentalist movements, as women often are, that the larger discourse or the larger position is often a very male-centered or a masculinist position. And again, that can be very disturbing. So women, certain small groups of women, right-wing women, for example, may be able to make small gains within that, for example, rise up in an organization. But eventually, I think there is real concern about the larger ramifications of this male-centered position in terms of fundamentalism.
And we've just got a minute before our break, but lastly, nationalism, a male face there as well?
Very much so. If you look at the way we talk about nationalism as sort of really based on equality and citizenship, that everybody's part of it. But I think, as another feminist has pointed out very well, no nationalism extends equal rights to women and men. And I would include that, you know, for various groups, there are differences in terms of nationalism by ethnicity, class, gender, to sexuality, to name just a few.
We'll come back to that after the break. Jack Beattie, I want to get your first thoughts in here before we have to take a quick break away.
Well, this opens new vistas on this rapidly familiar problem. It's interesting to use the word nationalism in association with America. Isaiah Berlin says that nationalism is the response of, he likens it to the bent twig, that you bend the twig and it snaps back, and that historical humiliation is one of the dynamics of it. We haven't really had that in America. And also, we're not a nation in the sense that the Germans are a nation. You know, we're a multitude of nations. So it's I think it'd be worthwhile talking about what you see as American nationalism. We call it patriotism, and it has a different valence for us than historically.
We're going to come back to that after a break. We're talking tonight about the feminist critique of the current crisis. If women ran the world, would we be in this situation? Would it make a difference? And women, do you feel trapped in a clash of patriarchies unfolding right now on several continents? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined in the studio by Professor Jyoti Puri, a feminist and professor of sociology and women's studies at Simmons College. You can also join us online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're looking at a feminist critique of the current crisis tonight with Professor Jyoti Puri from Simmons College in Boston and with our own Special Coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty. Just before the break, we were talking about nationalism, and Jack, you raised the point that nationalism is not something that's always been associated with the United States. Jyoti Puri, you're kind of suggesting that there is a nationalist surge in the wake of September 11th, and that there's an interesting feminist view on that. How do you see it?
I'm going back to the distinction that Jack made between nationalism and patriotism, that a sense that what you're witnessing is more recognizable within a patriotic framework, and I think that's an important distinction. To the extent that patriotism is about this sort of notion of love for country, and is certainly a part of nationalism. But my concern with nationalism is that nationalism, like any other form of identity, is based on a series of inclusions and exclusions. In order to define what the nation is, or to put it differently, if one is going to love one's country, then one needs to think about who belongs in that country. So in that sense, the patriotism and nationalism are really not very easily separable.
And is there a gender piece to this, or
yes,
a feminist view?
Mm-hmm. And I think the piece that, you know, when you look at nationalism then in its larger context or in a larger way, the nationalism is ostensibly based on notions of equality and citizenship, as I was saying just before the break. But at the same time, there are always groups, and gender is an important piece of this, but there are groups that are always excluded in some ways. In other words, not all citizens are equal, despite the willingness or despite the intention to include. And I think the differences are based in terms of our legal systems, social systems, the fact that Muslim Americans are not really being seen as Americans, are really also being, you know, highlighted as Muslims. So as an example.
But are you also saying, Jyoti Puri, that when the nationalist flag gets raised, that somehow feminists are pushed out of the conversation? The feminist view is somehow part of that exclusion?
Not necessarily. I think what I'm saying is, as the nationalist flag gets waved, feminist critiques and concerns about the limitations of nationalism get sidelined. So I think in this fervor of stand up and be counted, let's, you know, love your country, show your love for your country right now, I think what we are forgetting is the limitations of nationalism, the underside of it, so as it were. And to give you an example of the underside is the parallel rise in racism and xenophobia. So, you know, just as you're going to love something, then the nationalism is also counterposed to what you're not, or what you don't love, or what is oppositional to you.
Mm-hmm. Jyoti Puri, we see on television Osama bin Laden sitting in Afghanistan surrounded by men. We see the parade of U.S. officials, again with the exception of Condoleezza Rice, one after another men. Do you see a battle of patriarchies unfolding in front of us here?
To some extent, yes. And I think patriarchy is an interesting word, but I think for the purposes of our discussion, I think it captures well what you're trying to get at. I think very much so. One of the examples of that is the ways in which it's only in the last few weeks that you're really seeing the Bush administration direct our attention to Afghan women. Now, feminists have been raising issues, feminists all over, not just feminists in Afghanistan, in Iran, other parts of the Middle East, the Third World, the United States, have been raising concerns with Taliban regimes and regimes prior to that in terms of their treatment of Afghan women. And so what's interesting and really problematic about this, that just within the last few weeks now, the Taliban's ostracization and marginalization of women is being seen as a litmus test of why they are so problematic. So in that sense, I think women are really being deployed and used, and it is, in that sense, a battle of patriarchies.
But you're saying that it's not that the West or the United States was so concerned about women in Afghanistan before September 11th.
Certainly the state was not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and patriarchy gets into it in another way, too. I just heard a fascinating report on NPR from John Burnett about the Pushtuns. Mm-hmm. It's a culture of honor. Vendetta is central to it. You insult somebody, you've got a war. And central to it, too, is the submission of women and the putting of women on a pedestal, such that if a Pushtun, if a couple aren't married and they even so much as see each other, they can each be killed or severely ostracized for this behavior. But, you know, there's an element of that in America, too. We are a culture of honor. Chivalry, Western chivalry, is all about that. It's all and integral to it is the idea of don't insult my woman. You know, and let me keep her on the pedestal and pure and inviolate, and I'm here to defend her. I mean, there is that element. As I was listening to this Pashtuns, I was thinking, this isn't so dissimilar from, say, Southern white behavior that's documented through history, which has this cult of honor in it, people going into duels and so on. And that survives. And the role of women in the honor is just so interesting. Keep them inviolate.
We're entertaining a feminist critique of the current crisis this evening. Was the attack on September 11th male? Is our response male? Is there another way, a feminist way? Or are we all in this, male and female, together? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And there are a lot of people who want to join already. Let's bring in a caller. Genevieve is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hello, Genevieve. You're on the line.
Hi. Yep.
Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to make the comment that I think, and I'm glad because it relates to what you were just talking about, mm-hmm. But I think that we tend to, well, the main thing is that I see it as a Holocaust for women that's going on in the same way that we would say that Holocaust for Jews or the apartheid is a Holocaust for South African blacks.
A Holocaust since 9/11, Genevieve?
Oh, no. I mean, a lot of things that go on all over the world with women, and that mm-hmm. I think that in Afghanistan or in situations with Muslims, it's often not wanted to be discussed or touched on in that way because it's a religion, and we don't like to mess with people's religions. But when you look at the actual living conditions of women and the restrictions, as much the same what happened to Jewish people in Europe, right before the war, taking away little by little all types of rights mm-hmm. and banishing people to live in certain areas.
And Genevieve, what about American women? Clearly, it's not a Holocaust here.
What is that when you guys talk about feminists, it's as if feminists are these people that defend women and that men like George Bush and other men shouldn't feel exactly the same way, that women are human beings, that women are, you know, I guess could be put in a group, but in our country we have a lot of freedoms as women, and I think that we don't want to necessarily, I know that we don't understand the cultures of Afghanistan people. We couldn't put our exact situation on them, but mm-hmm. in some way look at the actual medical conditions and living mm-hmm. conditions in terms of what is humane to people living on the earth.
Genevieve, thanks for your call. Thank you. Jody Puri, what do you hear in Genevieve's comments?
I hear something important, and I hear, I think, the parallel to the Holocaust. I hear the idea about how that what Genevieve was talking about, this kind of gradual erosion of civil liberties, among other things, of marginalized groups, and how that can be, on hindsight, taken as an indicator of the repressive policies of any regime. And I think I hear that parallel very well, in that feminists have talked about the importance of using women's status in any culture as an important indicator of the legitimacy of a particular regime or a particular government. And I think I'm hearing that parallel in her comments. And again, it's, you know, some of the feminist concerns about one of the first acts that President Bush did when he came into office was, you know, sort of putting back into place the gag laws about so that groups that get federal funding cannot talk about abortion, even as an option for women to consider. Mm-hmm. So I think that there are differences of degrees mm-hmm. that we really should pay attention to.
Mm-hmm. I want to bring another guest into our conversation now. We're joined by Ambassador Swanee Hunt. She's founder of Women Waging Peace and director of the Women in Public Policy Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Good evening, Ambassador Swanee Hunt.
Good evening.
Thanks very much for being with us. You've paid a lot of attention to power politics and how they work, especially in times of crisis. You know, do you see women or the feminist viewpoint missing from the processes and outcomes once a crisis is underway?
Well, it's extremely important in this discussion that we frame it by saying that no one here in this discussion is saying that all men are one way or all women are one way.
Absolutely.
But,
we're with you.
Okay. But when I hosted negotiations during the war in Bosnia, it was striking to me that in 14 days of negotiations, there were no women out of about 100 different people who were meeting together in various shifts. There were no women, even though the Yugoslav women had more PhDs per capita than any other country in Europe. So somehow, when it came to the issue of holding the line and, you know, making sure that we didn't lose too much territory,
standing up for your side.
That's right. And I had the same concept confirmed when I was meeting with the UN once and asked why there were no women on the negotiating teams in some of the African conflicts, and was told by the UN officials they're afraid to put women on their teams because they're afraid the women will compromise, as if that's not the whole point of a negotiation.
I should clarify for our listeners, Swanee Hunt, that you were ambassador to Austria and worked extensively with peace negotiations during the Balkan War. So give us your perspective. Why should women be involved? Is there something unique that they bring that's missing when they're not there?
We can't say if it's because of biology or if it's because of social roles that women have learned, but we can say that there's a real difference in what women bring into these conflict situations. They tend to be quite adept at working outside of the power structure, so they're used to going up and over and through situations. They have very high motivation because they are wanting to protect their families, and they tend to not be oriented toward the state and sovereignty mm-hmm. and this territory line. They tend to do a much better job of bridging divides. I've seen that all over the world, women being able to connect mother to mother across the conflict mm-hmm. lines. And, I mean, I was in Rwanda and saw Hutus and Tutsis who had created a group together called Let Us Console Each Other, even though the consoling was because some were widows of because of the genocide perpetrated
by the others,
mm-hmm. and the women on the other side were grieving because their husbands were in prison because of the genocide.
Ambassador Hunt, I know we've just got you for another minute, but let me ask you, how could women in Afghanistan and the United States make a difference in this current conflict?
The important peace is that women be brought to the policy table. They should be at the heart of the conversations at the United Nations and in the U.S. and any other place where policies are being contemplated.
But that sounds like a process of years, and this is going on right now. It's unfolding day by day.
It's not at all a process of years. It can happen tomorrow.
How?
In terms of the people who are thinking of the post-Taliban regime, those mm-hmm. planners need to include Afghan women.
And what are we missing by not having them at the table today, and from the American side, for that matter?
We are missing the perspective they bring by having their fingers on the pulse of their communities. And we will design all kinds of ideas that won't work when we attempt to implement them on the ground.
Jack Beatty, you've been reading H.L. Mencken on the subject of women and their impact. Things haven't turned out quite as he anticipated.
Well, you know, he thought that it would that the women's getting the vote would simply change American politics out of all recognition, that it would eliminate corruption, and that the whole dialogue about war would shift. But when he was writing that, that was 1920. Within months of 1919, 1920, two things happened. Women got the right to vote. And in the Volstead Act, women essentially took the first chance to change male behavior, the kind of male socialization that was a scourge of family life in the 19th century. The saloon, the target of the Volstead Act, of prohibition, was not only a place of drinking, it was a place of gambling and almost invariably prostitution. And these two impulses, getting the vote and trying to change male behavior, that first impulse sort of went by the board. The high watermark of that was really prohibition. And instead, you got the just voting, and it was voting without changing male behavior. This same debate came up again in the feminist movement in the late 1960s and 70s, when feminism was all about changing the way men and women related, and it was about a fundamental change about how we think about sexuality. And it had a utopian energy to it. But in the 70s, just as that impulse to change male behavior went off in the 1920s, diminished. So in the 1970s, equal rights feminism tended to put this other kind of transformative feminism in the shade, and perhaps to our detriment, because this idea of changing socialization is very important for questions of war and peace.
Professor Jodi Puri, what about that? There was a great effort to bring women more into the centers of power in the United States. It didn't turn out quite as radically to come to pass as some had hoped. Did that failure and failures abroad set the table somehow for the conflict we're in now?
I think to some degree, I think it certainly seems to have shaped the response to the conflict. And I want to go back and make two points about what Jack just said. Mm-hmm. And one is that I think one cannot overemphasize the importance of women getting the vote. But also in the 1920s, the ways, you know, it's interesting which women got the vote and at what cost. So that a number of, they were largely middle-class white feminists who also allied with middle-class white men in order to argue for the vote vis-a-vis women of color or certain women in colonial circumstances. Mm-hmm. So I think one is that sort of that tension about the importance of bringing into the fold, but also the constantly asking which women are we bringing in here. So that my point is really that all women's interests are not simply homogeneous, that there are differences between those.
And Swanee Hunt, what would you say, Ambassador, do we see in this conflict somehow, do we feel the void, the absence of the full presence of women's power and perspective?
Absolutely. I'm very struck with this critique in terms of women giving up the transformative process. I was just now, literally an hour ago, at a meeting with this colloquium of women waging peace, and a Cambodian woman described the crying that had gone on that day as women from 20 different conflict areas described what had happened and told their stories. And she said if it had been men around the table, instead of crying, they would have been pounding their fists on the table. And she slammed the table. And she said because their impulse would be revenge and to hit back.
Mm-hmm. Swanee Hunt, thanks so much for joining us this hour.
Sure.
Ambassador Swanee Hunt is founder of Women Waging Peace and director of the Women and Public Policy Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. We're talking about a feminist critique of the current crisis. We're joined this hour by Professor Jodi Puri, professor of sociology and women's studies at Simmons College in Boston. She's author of the forthcoming book, Introducing Nationalism. Also with us, our own news analyst, Jack Beatty. And we welcome you as well. There are a lot of callers. We'll try and get them in after the break. Here's the question. If women ran the world, would we be in this crisis? Would it make a difference? And women, do you feel trapped in a clash of patriarchies? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, or join us online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're opening our minds tonight to a feminist critique of the current crisis. How do you see it? Would things be different if women were in charge? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined by Professor Jyoti Puri. She's Professor of Sociology and Women's Studies at Simmons College in Boston, and we have a lot of people who want to join the conversation. Let's go there right now. Simon is on the line. Welcome, Simon.
Thank you, Tom and Jyoti. Hi.
Hi.
I was watching... Conan O'Brien, I believe it was, late night TV, and he had on as the guest NBC's medical expert, Dr. Bob Arnott. He's all over the NBC. You know, he's been around for years.
Okay. And it's all men so far. Where are we going here?
Well, what he said was that the Islamic leaders in the Middle East, and the Taliban specifically, banning American television, the movies, the American culture, because of the violence towards women in that. I mean, the pornography, which America sort of like produces of virtually all the world's porn, between 80% and 90%. And we don't have to talk about it. It's almost mainstream now. Women with the animals, everything else. So grotesque. And, of course, we have millions of prostitutes and tens of millions probably of ex-prostitutes in America.
Simon, we got your point. I got a lot of calls. I want to put
question?
It to you. Well, sure. Shoot.
To do with this. Seeing that, is it, you know, when Bin Laden says that the American people are being held hostage, that they're captives, and they should rise up, he says, against their Jewish masters who control the government, the media, the banks, the corporate structure. This is similar to what the president says about the people of Afghanistan rising up to overthrow their religious Taliban masters.
But you're saying maybe it's the Islamic world that's looking and positioning itself as the protector of women. And let's get Jyoti Puri's response to that. Jyoti Puri, what about this? What if it's the other way around? What if it's not the way we perceive it?
Simon, I think it's an interesting point that you raise. And I think there is I would be a little bit uncomfortable about saying, taking the position that, yes, the Taliban are banning all of these things just because of violence against women. Again, I think it's just a symptom and an excuse for a larger set of issues.
But Simon's saying maybe this is a group trying to stand up and say, we don't like the way the West treats and portrays and exploits its women, and we want to protect our women from that. Is there some kind of proto-feminism in that, or is it just the opposite somehow? It's confusing.
And I think the word is confusing because in some ways it's a very legitimate critique to make. Certainly there is, you know, a tremendous amount of violence and the critique is justified, but their alternative is hardly proto-feminism.
Yeah.
So in that sense, again, the issue you used about the battle of patriarchies, I mean, in some ways I think you see that unfolding here as well.
Let's keep the calls coming. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Therese is calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Welcome, Therese.
Thank you.
Sure.
I'm not sure if I want to respond to Simon or what you were talking about earlier.
Take it where you will, Therese.
Yeah.
You're in charge.
Okay. In terms of, do I feel caught? Yes, I absolutely feel caught in a masculine model. However, I feel that the response that the U.S. has made is appropriate in that it follows a dominator model of leadership versus one of partnership. In fact, I think this war, along with the ecology disaster that we're in, the crisis in the medical system, is an example of the crisis of the feminine. When this attack started October 11th, I turned to some of Gandhi's materials, and I heard the military voice saying the special ops teams are going to be having certain successes that we'll never know about, and that it's best we not know because we couldn't stomach them.
But yet you're saying, Therese, that you're glad for the dominator model. What do you mean by that?
The dominator model to me is one of exclusivity, one of power over, one of control.
And you're saying you welcome that in the U.S. response to 9/11.
I think we're still in that as a society, as mm-hmm. a globe. For me, it was a great struggle to feel very American and very grateful to be an American. However, I am first a human, and I'm second a woman experiencing what it means to be a human, and I am a mother. And so the flag that I want to put out on my front yard is one of the earth. And if we can stretch to being both and rather than an either or, and see in Afghanistan sort of the masculine out of step with the feminine. It's an extreme example for me of looking in a mirror saying, ah, if we continue with this kind of power over, this is where we'll be. And in terms of Simon's point, the abuse of women and the misunderstanding of sexuality is, I think, a blossom of the dominator model.
Teresa, you're great. Please call again, but we've got a lot of calls we want to bring in, and I want to put your thought to Jody Puri, but thank you so much for calling. Jody Puri, what about this? Now, maybe I misinterpret, but what I hear is Therese is saying we've got to watch out for the ecology, for humanity, for the medical system, for the earth, and yet she's welcoming the dominator model, the George W. Bush large in charge right now. Is there a contradiction there or not?
I think there is a profound contradiction here. And
I don't think this is an unusual response among American women, by the way.
I'm glad you said that, and I think this is sort of, I think not only for American women, but you were also asking me about the issue of feminist critique. I think this real profound sense of ambivalence, both about the futile nature of this war on the one hand, but also a sense of nationalist, patriotic, response that maybe this is the only option we have. I think this is coming out because there are no clearly perceivable alternatives that have been put forth in front of the American public. And I think that's the problem. So therefore, the contradictions.
Teresa, thanks for your call. Michelle is calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Welcome, Michelle. You're on the line.
Hi. I know Teresa, and I know she doesn't welcome the dominator model.
Okay. Maybe it's my misinterpretation.
Yeah, she knows that that's the only alternative we're working within.
Got
right
it.
Now. Mm-hmm. And I've noticed the same thing. I definitely feel trapped by a clash of patriarchies. And I believe that it stems directly from a belief in a male god. And when you believe in a male god, you set up domination and you set up superiority and you silence parts of whatever culture you're in that you don't feel falls within that superior model. And without the integration of the masculine and feminine, then all you have left is either people drive, flying into buildings or, my fear is that we're going to ruin our civilization. We'll make an end to our civilization.
Michelle, thanks so much for your call. We're running right down to the end of our time, and I'd love to go on with everybody tonight, but I want to get Jody Puri's response to that, and thank you, Michelle. Jody Puri, what about this? Michelle ties it right down to the belief in the male god. That's something that most Americans share with Osama bin Laden.
I think Michelle's point about indicting masculinity, especially as it's linked to a male god, I think is an important one. However, I hate to say this, but I don't think it is just linked to a male god. I grew up in a culture with a polytheistic religion. Which
you grew
is
up in Bombay, India.
That's right, where the dominant religion is Hinduism, and it's a polytheistic religion. We have gods, goddesses
of all genders,
kinds, of all degrees, the good gods, the not-so-good gods, and still, the masculinity, the domination, the masculine dominance, I think, is to be found in that context as well.
Jody Puri, I want to thank you for being with us tonight. It's been great to have you.
My pleasure.
I hope we can continue the conversation. This is a perspective we want to stay close to. Jody Puri is professor of sociology and women's studies at Simmons College in Boston. She's author of the forthcoming book, Introducing Nationalism. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me here.
Jack Beatty. Well, there it is. I'm glad we cracked this open tonight, and I hope it's not the last time we talk about it. But it feels like it's time to air out this room of conflict and to really get this broader perspective in here.
Yeah, and we keep hearing the phrase, I feel trapped. And I know that it isn't just women who feel trapped, but they feel it, I think, acutely. And we've been hearing that trap between, as you were saying, the imperatives of patriotism, love of country, and on the other hand, the fear about the means we're using in this war, the bombing and so on. I think that, there was a statement from a Pakistani woman in the paper the other day, and I thought, if we could get to that point, what a moral transformation. She said, babies, she was talking about a dead Afghan baby. She said, babies are all equal all over the world. if we can get to that perspective, and if feminists can help us to get to that perspective, we will have gone to the moral heights here.
And yet, Jack, the kind of savagery of September 11th and the chest puffing of the response, though God knows we understand the anger and the need to respond, it all feels very, very old. It doesn't feel new. It doesn't feel progressive in any way.
No, I wouldn't say so. I mean, when a nation is threatened like that, as we were, you fall back on the most basic, some would call atavistic responses. But you know, other people are saying the Bush administration is proceeding very carefully here and slowly, and that maybe they're not going to turn this into a bomb for 3 years campaign. That maybe they'll come to their senses.
We can hope that bit by bit we pull in a full range of perspectives here.
Yeah,
we'll hope. And go Condoleezza Rice, though I don't know her. You can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. In 1979, Moorhead Kennedy was taken hostage in Tehran while serving as active economic counselor at the U.S. Embassy. Since his release, he's worked to educate others about terrorism and how to respond to its underlying roots. Mr. Kennedy spoke yesterday at the John F. Kennedy Library about parallels between the motivations of his young Iranian captors in Tehran and those of the terrorists that brought down the World Trade Center. Here are excerpts from his talk.
I was thinking back on how much our captivity in Iran, which lasted from November 4th, 1979 through January 20th of 81, how much that foreshadowed some of the issues that have been raised by the attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. I think the worst mistake that we can make is to dismiss terrorists as lunatic, as irrational, because mine were highly rational. It was a student-manned group. The average age of the leadership was in the early 30s. They had been, as it were, graduate students. One of them, their principal leader, Hossein Sheikh al-Islam, who later became deputy foreign minister and is now ambassador to Damascus, got his M.A. from the University of California at Berkeley. But they took advantage of the growing chaos in Iran to seize us as a way of bringing about still worse chaos. Some of the elements that you see today came out in that, and I think the first and most important to remember is this was a way to pay back the United States, as they said constantly, for its great crimes as the great Satan. Well, we have been the top nation, and the West has prevailed. The Islamic world has been subordinated. Very deep down in countries from Morocco out to Jakarta, there is a feeling it's now our turn. And so when Americans were shocked when they saw the demonstrations going on after the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, people dancing in the streets in Jakarta, way out in Indonesia, in Palestinians, and people in Jordan rejoicing, there was the feeling it's their turn now. It wasn't that they approved the taking of the lives, but it was the act of hitting us hard that was very important. It is terribly important not to underestimate the idealism that motivates a lot of younger people and draws them into terrorism. Our group, some of the younger ones particularly, thought that this would touch off a world revolution, the poor against the rich. Bonding is terribly important. Ours was a student group that had gone underground in 1972, and they reinforce each other. When you read of Muhammad Atta and the others, lonely students in Hamburg getting together, you can see how much psychological reinforcement they gave each other. And finally, of course, the deed. the taking of the embassy was a great moment for them. Just like for the early anarchists, the shooting of President McKinley or various European figures was critically important. And today, knocking over our most impressive buildings, it is the deed that motivates them. And it certainly motivated our captors. These are some of the elements that we should have paid attention to. But when we came back, the State Department didn't even want to debrief us. They didn't want to know the names of our captors. The war was over. We had won. Reagan was president, and it would never happen again. And ladies and gentlemen, it's happened again, and it's going to happen more.
That was Moorhead Kennedy, former hostage in Tehran, speaking yesterday at the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBU.